Tonight is the last talk in this series on the formation of self, and it's called The End of Karma. So we talked last week about how karma is defined as volitional action, and how what happens in this seeming continuity of a person is that we repeat the same patterns of volitional actions again and again, and because one moment conditions the next, it leads to a reappearance of something like the same being, either moment to moment or the continuation of those patterns into a new birth. So in the talk this week, I want to explore how the patterns get created and then through Dharma practice, how they get undone, how we become bound and how we become free. So to start, we need to look at the relation between two key concepts that we've been talking about a lot, which are karma and anatta. Because at first glance, these two seem quite contradictory. Anatta is the not-self, the teaching there's no fixed entity within this mind-body process. Karma is the teaching that actions done come back to me, not to you. So how do those two go together? So this was raised by a monk in the Buddha's time. He asked the Buddha, "What self then will actions performed by the not self affect?" That's kind of the hub of it, isn't it? There's no self here performing the actions, but then they land somewhere. And the Buddha basically said, "You haven't been listening to me. You just don't get it." So at first, these two concepts seem opposed to each other, but actually what I want to talk about tonight is how they need each other to make sense. They don't work without one another. So to understand this a little more, we want to look into a little more this concept of not-self. When we say there is no abiding entity within this mind-body process that stays the same, that doesn't deny individuality and the uniqueness of a person. It's not that when we see not self, we all of a sudden merge into this ecstatic oneness of unity with the cosmos. That doesn't happen like that. And a nice way to think about it is to look at the phenomenon we call a stream. So we could take the stream that flows out of this end of Gaston Pond if you're walking around to the loop, and after a rain, the pond overflows, and down at the north end, it spills out, and the stream runs on. I don't know if it has a name, but we could call it Gaston Stream, just to designate it. So this stream, a stream is defined as, I looked on the internet, it must be true, a body of water flowing in a channel. Okay? So it is essentially, the stream is that body of water. Is that constant or changing? Oh, bhikkhus. It's changing, right? You go by the side of the stream, you look down, the water keeps appearing and disappearing, flowing, it's always moving. Heraclitus said you never step in the same river twice. So it's constantly in process, flowing, there's nothing the same from one moment to the next, yet there is something that continues about that stream. It stays down there, it doesn't move up into the meditation hall. It's contained most of the year between two banks of roughly the same height. And it's very different from the Connecticut River, which is probably about 30 miles west of here. And it's very useful for us to know that the Gaston Stream is not the same as the Connecticut River. So there's nothing fixed within this stream, and yet if we give it this designation, Gaston Stream, it's meaningful. It means something to us. And there's a continuity to the stream because of the banks, and the body of water keeps showing up there, at least after a rain. So in Buddhism, sometimes we talk about sentient beings as being a mind stream, or we could say having a mind stream. So again, this word stream comes in a very helpful way. Each of us is or has, whichever you prefer, a mind stream. This stream is constantly flowing. It's made up of sense contact, perceptions, feelings, thoughts, images, emotions, all the factors of enlightenment, all the hindrances keep moving through this mind stream. There's nothing in it that is fixed. It's constantly flowing. But there is a mind stream here that we conventionally designate as Guy. There is a mind stream right over here that we conventionally designate as Greg. And it's useful to know that those two are different, right? So I don't drive his car when I leave tonight, and I don't end up in his bed when I go home tonight, and vice versa. So the not fixedness, that's the meaning of not self. There's nothing that's fixed or stuck in here. Yet there is some continuity, and we can call this a being that has an ongoing nature that's somewhat definable and predictable, and that's a useful thing to know, that designation. So there's a continuity in the stream, in the body of water, continues in the same channel. There's a continuity in a person. And that continuity is that these characteristics, thoughts and images and feelings and perceptions and factors of mind, continue in a somewhat predictable way. They don't change their nature totally overnight. And the sum of these characteristics is what we call personality, to use a common Western term. So what is personality? And how is it that everybody's personality is unique? So you look around the world, there are people with very different personalities. Some people are generous, some people are stingy, some people are caring, some people are indifferent, some people are shy, some people are extroverted, some people are funny, some people are gloomy. You see all this range. So what makes up personality? How do you establish your idea of somebody's personality? I think that we look at how they act, how they speak, and kind of underneath that is the root, how they're thinking and feeling. I think this more or less encompasses personality as we commonly use it. People's thoughts and feelings, their speech, and their bodily actions. Does this sound like anything we've talked about before? Volitional actions of body, speech, and mind are known as karma. So I'm going to suggest that personality is nothing more than repetitive patterns of karma. Or we could say karmic patterns. That's what our personalities are. And they're somewhat predictable. They feel solid. If you haven't examined them closely, an ordinary person in the world who hasn't looked at the mind-body process closely might feel their personality is something solid or fixed. But you and I know that it's just due to the arising and passing nature of different mental formations that are coming and going all the time, but happen in these predictable or repetitive patterns that give a sense of continuity. And these patterns are formed from our own volitional actions. Our tendencies to laziness or diligence, generosity or stinginess, shyness or extroversions are expressions of our own urges. So our own karmic patterns are forming the personality out of our own volitions, enacted again and again and again. So as we start to tune into what our personality is, and we start to wake up maybe as a human being in our teens or late teens, and we start to realize, I've got a personality, I'm somebody in the world, these patterns become a primary basis for our self-view, for forming sakkaya ditti, for having a belief about who we are in the world. So to put it simply, we identify with these karmic formations and the habits of mind. And we say, I am a generous person, or I am not a generous person, or I am a caring person, or an angry person, or a loving person, or whatever. So we make an identification about the patterns that we see, and we're identifying with aspects of our personality. We don't see that they're all arising and passing. We sort of say, this is who I am, and we fix it. We make something solid and ongoing, which is, again, an attempt to create a sense of security through permanence, lasting sense of self over time. So the fact that this sense of self lasts over time, it starts off as a solution to a problem, but it actually becomes a much bigger problem. Because once we start believing that this personality is fixed, and I've always been this way in the past, and this is how I am today, and I'm always going to be this way in the future, this starts to feel like a very heavy burden. And at times in practice, this becomes the biggest felt obstacle to liberation. I've got this pattern I just can't find my way out of. And it feels like a heavy weight on my shoulders. For me, the key element of this pattern was fear. And it felt very oppressive that I'd recognized it being there for a while, and I felt it in the present, and I projected it into the future. We didn't see this sense of I forming when we were young. We weren't trained to look at the mind in this way. So as a teenager, probably, we started to form the idea of who we are as a person in the world and solidify it, but it wasn't clear to us that we were doing that. And so there was ignorance baked in from the very beginning in this concept of personality. So this is how we form self-view, this is how we take on becoming someone, and ignorance underlies it because we don't see the changing nature of the experiences we're claiming as I. So personality is bound up in ignorance, and it's bound up in becoming someone in the world. So as you know, there are many, many different types of personalities. And the key components of a lot of personalities in the world are based on some combination of greed, aversion, and delusion. So this becomes an interesting thing to investigate. What's the driving force behind these personality types that we see? So I'm going to talk first about some unwholesome personalities, and I'm going to name a few. This is not a list from DSM-4 or any kind of diagnostic manual. This is just people I've met in the world who I remembered as being a certain way. And I want you to think of them as personality types. Now, we all have these tendencies of mind. So it's not that you have this tendency, therefore you're that. But rather, a personality type is someone who has built their approach to life around a tendency. So it got hardened early on for some combination of factors as a central defining characteristic of their relation to the world. And then they kind of structured their being, their responses to the world, around this one habit. So a personality gets layered on top of a central urge, kind of primal urge from the mind. So I'm just going to name some different personalities. This is just a random list from my own observation. And as I name them, I'll do it a little slowly. I invite you to think of what kind of person this is, and you might have known someone like this, and what the predominant kilesa is. Is the predominant force one of greed or aversion or delusion? So I'll just go through a short list. Different personalities. Dependent or addictive. Craving for attention. Ambitious. Controlling. Fearful. Aggressive. Perfectionist. Self-critical. Melancholy. Spacey or confused. So just to notice that we can take any of these urges and a whole life can be built around trying to satisfy it, making this the predominant interest in our life. So these are examples of difficult patterns with some suffering. Patterns can also be based on a combination of wholesome and unwholesome motives. One example, a compulsive helper. Somebody who's always trying to fix you, whether you want to be fixed or not. And let's say this isn't your mother. A very strict moralist. Somebody who's really into ethical conduct and morality, but they hold it rather tightly. Being in monasteries gives you a good chance to observe this particular personality pattern, because this tends to be the Vinaya expert in the monastery. They memorized all 227 or 254 rules. They think it has to be done perfectly, and they think you should do it perfectly. So it's a wholesome underpinning, but it's just held a little too tightly. And then there are the personality patterns that are really wholesome. Like, you know, someone who's really loving, you know, really generous, really compassionate, really diligent in their practice or giving to the world. So these patterns, I almost hesitate to use the word pattern, because the felt sense of these actions, if you feel around the person or you feel in yourself when you're in one of these modes, is that they're not coming from a blind habit, but they're kind of arising freely out of the openness of heart and mind. So they're not constricted in the same way that the other patterns are. Nonetheless, they are habits, but they're not habits of suffering particularly. So I'm going to talk tonight primarily about the habits that come from suffering, because these are the ones that we really want to understand through practice. So all these patterns are created through our own volitions, but over time, that force of habit becomes a compulsion. And we feel it takes away our freedom. We don't really have the option to follow it through or not, because there's so much momentum behind the habit that it becomes impossible at times to step outside of it and to interrupt that pattern. So basically what we're talking about here is a kind of fundamental change in personality. And as you know, that's not easy to do. The stepping out of these patterns is not so easy. So how does Dharma practice bear on this? Let's talk about language for a minute. I think the Buddha's teaching is all about stepping out of these patterns of thinking and feeling and speaking and acting. But the language doesn't make it always so apparent, because his language is around words like craving and clinging and becoming. Those sound kind of dry. And when I read the list of the personality types that I've observed, they're a lot juicier. Fear, aggression, spaciness, controlling, ambitious. Wow, this is where it's really happening. So this is more the ground of Western psychology. Western psychology kind of takes off from these character traits. But the important thing to understand is that the Buddha's language, craving, clinging, becoming, is just shorthand for these things. The kilesas express themselves differently in each of us due to different conditions of our upbringing and what we were surrounded with as children. The kilesas kind of got crystallized in each of us in different ways. And these crystallized formations are what we call our habitual patterns or our personality. But the root stuff of these patterns is greed, aversion, delusion, craving, clinging, and becoming, self-view. So it's all there. So when the Buddha talks about craving, clinging, becoming, we need to unpack it in terms of our actual experience. And sometimes our actual experience is just very simple. We see greed in the moment, we see aversion in the moment, we see delusion in the moment. Sometimes it's more complex. What really weighs us down is this ongoing personality pattern that we find coming again and again, and that becomes what we feel most bound by, most burdened by. But it's the same thing that the Buddha is pointing to. Here's one way that the Buddha described karma. I'm going to use the word action, but the original was the Pali word kamma. Action makes the world go round. Action makes this generation turn. Living beings are bound by action, like the chariot wheel by the pin. The image of it, that the pin is attaching the chariot wheel to the axle, and it's just spinning round and round because of that pin. So we're bound by our actions because they've created these compulsive habits that have worn grooves in our mind, and we act out of them again and again in ways that aren't so skillful to ourselves or to others. That's how we're bound by our karma. So, and underneath it are the forces of craving and clinging. So here we're in the territory of the first and second noble truths. There's suffering, and the cause of it is the underlying craving. But we want to talk about how we undo these patterns. So we want to move into the territory of the third noble truth, the end to suffering. And the beautiful truth is, this is where anatta becomes so helpful. In truth, nothing is fixed in us. Nothing in these patterns are fixed. They're just habits. Habits don't have to re-arise in a new moment. So if we substitute new habits for the old habits, they can be altered, they can be changed, they can be completely undone. So that's where Dharma practice takes its root, is the undoing of these patterns. So as we come and sit, and as you've been doing for 6 weeks now, a lot of time to observe these arisings, sometimes out of the blue, these old ways of thinking and feeling will come up, and that's often just the emergence of old karma. Sometimes it comes up through bodily energy. Sometimes it just comes up as a habit in the mind. And you just kind of recognize, that's just old stuff that got generated a long time ago, and I'm just on the receiving end of it. This happens so often in meditation, and it's really helpful to start to see, this is just an old habit of mind coming into the present moment. If we meet them and believe in them the way we always have, you know, that's who I am, and the situation it's describing is really true, and I really need to mobilize to do something about that, then we're spinning that chariot wheel one more time. We're binding ourselves to that old habit again by believing in it and giving it that power. But fortunately, and you know, we've heard this so many times from you in interviews, mindfulness comes in, sees the old pattern, the old feelings, but in a new way. Mindfulness can meet them and not be so seduced by the story, that long-lasting nature of the habit, what we think we should do because of the story that it tells. And as we can just observe it, we see how it arises, it lasts for a while, and it passes away. Every time we don't believe in the story of that old habit, we weaken its grip. Mindfulness, just by observing without reactivity, understands arising, persisting, passing, nothing more, just like a weather formation. And then we're not reinforcing it. We're actually weakening that. It's kind of like the chariot wheel is spinning, but we're rubbing a brake pad against it. And mindfulness is that brake pad wearing the pattern down. So, mindfulness is new karma. It's a new response. It's a new volitional action in relation to the old karma that's come up. And this response leads in the direction of freeing us. It starts to weaken the old pattern. So, one of the things that's so freeing is we can see that, for instance, fear can arise. And normally our old reaction would be, something's wrong. I got to deal with whatever that fear is pointing to. It's dealing to something in the future that's going to be a disaster. I got to go take care of that. But we don't. We can just stay present, watch fear come, know that it's simply an emotion, it's only a state of mind, and watch it pass away and there's not a disaster. So this is the point at which we really start to feel the freedom that's growing from our practice. We can be with these very difficult states, old patterns, and not get seduced by them, not get conned by them, but to see clearly this is just an emotion. So often we can do this. This is a great new skill. And sometimes we can't. Sometimes the pattern comes and we fall into it again. So this can get really discouraging because now we know better. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. We know that we shouldn't be falling into it again, believing in it, acting on it, or whatever, but we can't help it. The pattern comes in, we're in its grip again, we feel that way, we think that way, we believe that way, and maybe we even act that way. So this can become very discouraging for the meditator because we know better, but we can't act better. And it's frustrating. So here's the place where the meditator really needs a lot of patience. Because you can start to feel like, oh, this is proof the whole thing isn't working. But it is working. The fact that you've seen the shift is the big thing in it. The fact that it sometimes doesn't happen is just kind of incidental. But it is discouraging. Sally and I were teaching in California, I think it was about a year and a half ago, on a retreat with Trudy Goodman. I think it was Dedicated Practitioners Retreat. Trudy's a teacher in LA. And we were talking, Trudy was talking about this subject of emotions and patterns, and somebody raised their hands and made the comment, but I just can't stand it. I'm so tired of seeing my same old stuff come again and again and again. It's just my same old stuff. This isn't really an expression of that in-between place. And Trudy's response was, well, whose stuff would you like to have? I thought that was a great answer. Would you really benefit from having somebody else's? We all have stuff and it's all the same process, so you might as well make our peace with our stuff. So this is kind of an in-between stage, that we know enough that we know a different relationship is possible, but we sometimes still fall in to the old grip of it. But the important thing is, once you really start to see how mindfulness transforms your relationship to the emotion or the pattern, it starts to cut the root of the thing. You don't believe in it fully anymore. So you're like cutting through some fundamental root that's kept it anchored. And you know, if you cut the root of a tree, the leaves don't all fall away right at once. You can cut the root, and the tree can still look pretty healthy for quite a while, you know, because there's still juice in the trunk and in the branches. So don't get worried if the leaves don't all fall at once. Once you've cut through the trunk of it, and you just really don't believe in it in the same way, eventually the tree's going to die, but you have to be patient because you don't know how long it's going to last. So mindfulness has this power of taking the energy out of the pattern. And you can feel this when you're in relationship to one of these old visitors. The stronger mindfulness is, the less power the arising pattern or emotion has. And you can feel it kind of as you sit there, going into the awareness and coming out of the emotion. This is one of the powers that mindful attention has. It robs the energy from the pattern itself. And so the pattern is weaker through the effect of mindfulness. This is part of the effect of this word viraga. Sally talked about it a few nights ago in Transcendent Dependent Arising. It was quite close to the end. I think she mentioned that it has to do with the unconditioned. It's sometimes translated as fading away. It literally means without lust, but it has this connotation of fading away. And that's what happens as we relate mindfully with these patterns. They start to fade away, kind of like the, you know, the empty wraiths that they really are. They're seen as just a cloudy formation and nothing more. And then they start to fade under the power of mindfulness. So I think Sally was talking about, you know, basically greed, aversion, delusion fading. But remember, our patterns are just crystallized forms of greed, aversion, delusion. So as greed, aversion, delusion fade, they fade in all those different forms for each of us. So those patterns are thinning, becoming less intense, don't arise as often. When they arise, they're seen more clearly. This is the progression of Dharma practice. So I just want to emphasize what a different approach this is from, let's say, older forms of Western psychology, where it was assumed that each of these emotions had a genesis in our developmental history, and in order to work out the pattern, we had to go back to the genesis story and figure out, you know, was it our mother or our father or the teacher in first grade, and then we'd sort of trace it through. We don't need to deal with the past at all in this approach. We trust in the present moment meeting of the awareness with the pattern to do the thinning. Awareness brings in wisdom. We start to understand the empty nature of all these arisings, and we just don't take them so seriously anymore. So then, over time, these emotions that are part of the pattern may still arise, but they don't become the center point of our personality. And they just kind of go back into the normal flow, like everybody has these emotions. Children have these emotions. Grown-ups have these emotions. Just part of the flow. And they're not felt as so binding. So we don't know how long this will take for us in particular, for a particular pattern or emotion, but we do know this is the direction it goes in. There's this beautiful image from the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha is talking about this progress, and he's talking about it in terms of the fetters, which are just another description for the things that bind us. And he puts it this way. Suppose, bhikkhus, an ocean-going boat rigged with ropes, having been exposed to the water for 6 months, has been dragged to the shore for the winter. Then the ropes that had been affected by wind and sun, when soaked by the monsoon rains, will easily go to waste and rot away. It is similar with a bhikkhu who applies herself to the meditative development of her mind. Her fetters will easily be loosened and rot away. So meditative development, the Pali word that's being translated here is bhavana. And it basically says that as you shine the light of meditative attention or mindfulness on the fetters, the defilements, these old patterns, they will weaken and rot away like sails and riggings that have been exposed to the element and left out in the open air. So this turning to mindfulness is an intentional action. So the activation of the path itself is happening as a karmic process. So karmic process, you kind of want to know where it's leading. So we turn to one of the wisdom masters of the last century, Yogi Berra. And this is his quote. If you don't know where you're going, you could end up somewhere else. So let's find out where we're going. So in our Dharma practice, we're cultivating these wholesome mind states, and they come up more and more often as we practice them, as you've seen with mindfulness in this retreat. And not only does mindfulness come more often, but it brings all the factors of enlightenment with it. So all the wholesome factors are growing from the Vipassana practice. And on the metta side, another whole set of qualities of mind are being cultivated. Metta opens us up to love, compassion, and joy. These, I feel, so helpful for Westerners because as the metta grows, there's a new sense of self-confidence that comes. We feel metta alive in our heart. We turn within and we feel, oh, there's something good there. There's something I can really trust that's alive now. And we don't have to hide it or manipulate it. We can trust that can express in the world. So all these beautiful factors are growing from practice, mindfulness and determination and loving kindness and wisdom and renunciation and patience. These are all unfolding. When we came into Dharma practice, we hadn't had this understanding. We hadn't had this knowledge. And so we developed these unconscious ways of forming a self-image, crystallizing around greed, aversion, delusion in different ways. And that was our karmic stream. Our mind stream, formed from these various tendencies, was going in many not so wholesome directions, most likely. The suffering that brought us into practice was a sign of that. But the river had a definite flow. And we could say that at the point at which we discovered the Dharma, it was probably flowing into Lake Samsara. That we were going to keep creating these patterns and these actions again and again and again, and taking birth as who we believed ourselves to be. In Dharma practice, we start to get a new river coming from a different direction. Here's the one flowing to Lake Samsara. It's going out that way. A lot of energy. And this new river starts to come in with different karmic force. And this is the karmic force of mindfulness, loving kindness, wisdom, generosity, virtue, faith. And this little river at first, as it gets stronger and stronger, and you've had the chance to see how strong it can get in 6 weeks, starts to divert the original river. So as the current gets stronger and stronger, it starts pushing the first river in a new direction. And instead of flowing to Lake Samsara, we're now headed to the Nibbanic Ocean. That's the only direction this one goes, the Nibbanic Ocean. If there was something fixed in us, if these tendencies of ignorance and craving and greed and hatred, if those were planted in us, you couldn't divert this river. They couldn't be changed. But they're not fixed. They're all arising and passing, and so they're all essentially empty. That's the anatta aspect of our being, the essentially empty nature of who we are. There's nothing fixed in us. From the very beginning, even ignorance, which seems so fundamental, is not fixed and can be uprooted. So that's why this new karmic stream can come in and completely transform the flow of intention that's inside us. They can liberate us because the ignorance isn't fixed and the craving isn't fixed. So first we're bound by our own volitional actions. But as we understand how to use karma through the development of the path, our new volitional actions liberate the old ones. They release them, and ultimately they liberate us. What's the central feature in this shift? It's intention. Intention is our tool for change. It's really our only reliable tool for change. The Tibetans sum this up in a simple way. They say, everything rests on the tip of motivation. And in Dharma practice, that is what it's all about. The intention to be mindful, the intention to be loving, the intention to investigate, the intention to arouse energy, the intention to find concentration, the intention to awaken wisdom. These new intentions change everything. And it's a fantastic discovery that we can understand this tool of intention and its karmic effects. When I came into practice, my life seemed really chaotic. You know, it was a mixture of happiness and unhappiness. I didn't have any idea how to control that. I didn't have any idea how to stabilize. There were external things that were happening that were out of control, and my inner life was random, chaotic, out of control. I didn't know what to do. Then, when I found practice, I started to understand how to form wholesome intentions. So out of this chaotic mess, I discovered the power of intention. And you all have also. That's the beauty of the path. Because still, we're kind of afloat on a chaotic sea. We can't control the external conditions. We can't even control the health of this body. We can't control the flow of our own mind, the qualities of kilesa or the wholesome qualities. You come in for a sit, you don't know which is going to show up. But what we can do is keep reestablishing a wholesome intention. And as we do that, redirecting our life moment after moment starts to take us in a completely different direction. So intention, to me, is the rudder as we steer on this kind of vast and chaotic sea. Life is an uncertain proposition, but the one thing we can hold to and steer by is our good intention. That's really our best friend. And as we steer, we are going to a safe harbor. There is safety. There is a harbor. We talk about how there's no safety amid the changing conditions of life. That's true. But there is a harbor in the purification of heart and mind. That's what the Buddha was talking to. And there is a deep safety in discovering that. This is a dialogue from Nisargadatta Maharaj, a teacher that I appreciate a lot who wrote a book called I Am That. He's in dialogue with a Western visitor. Maharaj starts off with a statement. Your own will has been the backbone of your destiny. And the questioner said, surely karma interfered. Well, let's just parse this for a minute. Your own will is your own volitional actions. So that's our understanding of karma. Your karma, your actions have been the backbone of your destiny, similar to the equanimity phrase. And the questioner said, surely karma interfered. And so he's bringing in karma as kind of the result of past actions. You know, there's some predetermination, kind of. So Maharaj replies, karma shapes the circumstances of your life, but the attitudes are your own. Ultimately, your character shapes your life. And you alone can shape your character. This is profound. Ultimately, your character shapes your life, and you alone can shape your character. So how do we do that? How do we shape our character? It's through our own intentions. It's through our karmic directions. The teachings of the Buddha really point into threads, which we can practice either or both of. One thread is toward worldly happiness. And here, the intentions to be cultivated, the set of instructions, are basically, I don't want to go into this in a lot of detail, generosity, virtue, and loving kindness. Cultivated long enough, these three will lead to worldly human happiness. But some people are interested in addition to that, the path of liberation. So what's responsible for that? It's a different set of instructions. Includes those instructions, but it's bigger. And to understand that, we have to look at this the Buddha statement that for one who is awakened, a fully awakened being, for an arhat, there's no more karma. What does that mean? That is so weird. Because a fully awakened being still acts in the world. A fully awakened person's actions still come out of intentions. Hopefully now purely wisdom, you know, love, compassion, and so forth. But what does that mean? So I'll tell you the way I understand it. There can still be results of past actions for an arhat. For example, Angulimala, after he was awakened, remember he was the one who'd killed 999 persons, would go for alms in a nearby village and people would stone him. He came to the Buddha and said, well, people are stoning me when I go for alms and then they don't want to give me food. And the Buddha said, that's the result of your having killed 999 people. Bear it. That's going to happen. But the arhat, it said, doesn't create new karma. So what is the meaning of this? I think there's a clue in a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's number 4, where the Buddha describes the night of his enlightenment. Very interesting passage. I recommend it to you for reading. So it was the night that he sat under the Bodhi tree in what is now Bodh Gaya in northern India. And he describes that on that night, his mind had become concentrated, purified, bright, and malleable. Malleable, if you're not an English speaker, it means you can shape it. It's kind of fluid and you can work it in what direction you want. So once he developed this concentrated and malleable mind, he said he first directed it toward the recollection of his past lives. And he said he saw 1 birth, 2 births, 10 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births, where he was named so-and-so of such a clan and then died and reappeared as a different name and had a life and died. 100,000 births. And he said this was the first true insight that came on that night. Then he segues into the second insight, but he doesn't explicitly link the two. But I'm going to suggest, I'm going to infer that there is a connection. And I'm going to say the question that arose in his mind was, what shaped those births that he was seeing? So then, the second insight, he turned this concentrated, purified, bright, and malleable mind to seeing the death and reappearance of many beings across the earth. And it said that he saw beings dying and reappearing, that means being reborn, according to their karma. And he said that those who had lived lives with wholesome intentions were born into happy circumstances, and those who had lived lives with unwholesome intentions were born into unwholesome circumstances. So then there's a segue to the third insight of the night. And again, it's not explicit, but I'm going to infer it. And this is the part that I wanted to draw out because I think it's interesting. So the Buddha saw that if one lived with wholesome intentions, one would have a wholesome birth. If one lived with unwholesome intentions, unhappy birth. But even if one acts well in life, one is still born. And do you remember the definition of dukkha? Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, illness is dukkha, and death is dukkha. So even for one acting with good intentions, birth, aging, illness, and death still happen. And then the dying and reappearing, and one doesn't know the next birth. So even acting with good intentions, no refuge, no real refuge or safety, because one can't control the future births. So then, leading into the third insight of the night, I'm going to infer that he said, what is the way out of both good births and unhappy births? Then he said he directed his concentrated mind to the destruction of the taints. The taints are another list of very fundamental impurities of mind, the taint of sensual desire, the taint of becoming, and the taint of ignorance. And he said, by directing his attention to the destruction of the taints were destroyed. And he knew his mind was liberated. So I believe he had found a way in that moment out of the wheel of karma. He had seen the resolution of even the suffering of good births. And there are a couple of beautiful statements that he made after this moment. One of the things he said is, my deliverance is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being. And the other one is a poem that you've probably heard from the Dhammapada. Through many a birth I have wandered through samsara, seeking but not finding the builder of this house, the house being the mind and body. Painful is birth again and again. Householder, now you are seen. You will build no house again. All your rafters are broken. The ridgepole is shattered too. My mind has attained the unconditioned and reached the very end of craving. So how did this happen? So the Buddha saw that good karma did not provide a final refuge. And of course, unwholesome karma provided a very painful outcome. So he said, what karma is neither dark nor bright, with neither dark nor bright results, which leads to the destruction of karma? In other words, what action leads to the end of karma? It is this noble eightfold path, namely right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, that leads to the end of action and takes us out of the wheel of becoming, takes us out of samsara. If we go back two talks, I was talking about this quality of unentangled knowing, where by not grasping, we step out of the wheel of becoming, off the chain of dependent arising, and we rest with this full awareness of what is, but from a place that's been described differently by different teachers. Sayadaw Utejaniya calls it the pure citta. Upasaka Ki calls it unentangled knowing. One teacher called it the gap between feeling and craving. Ajahn Buddhadasa called it temporary nibbana. And we get there not by doing, 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 not by acting, 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 but by stopping. By stopping acting, by stopping clinging, by stopping effort, we come into this place of non-becoming, which is a resting in this open but aware place, and has a quality, as I said, of being unborn and undying. Now here's another quotation from the Buddha after his awakening. I discovered the unborn, unailing, undying, supreme security from bondage, nibbana. And I just want to highlight again, the Buddha found security. You know, we often say there's no security in the changing elements of this world, and that's true, but there is security from the fruition of the path, and this is what he discovered. The unborn, unailing, undying security. It's unailing, and that's why resting in this place is so healing. It's not ill. And as we rest there, our illness gets healed. The illness of the kilesas gets healed. We don't have to work it out on the level of emotions because we found a different dimension, and we move more into that dimension. It's this unailing element, unentangled knowing, the pure citta, temporary nibbana, that rots the fetters. The fetters can't last in that because their empty nature is revealed as empty. This is from the Buddha from the Udana. If there were not this unborn, unbecome, unconditioned, there would be no escape possible from what is born, become, conditioned. But because there is this unborn, unbecome, unconditioned, there is an escape possible from what is born, become, conditioned. So basically, it's the unbecome that frees us from the wheel of becoming, that keeps us from taking birth again and again and again. The element, the quality of this nibbana, I think we've alluded to, its qualities are things like peace and calm and stillness. And the Buddha described it like this: the stilling of all formations, the relinquishment of all attachments, the destruction of craving and cessation. That is nibbana. So it's the stilling of the formations, the stilling of karma, the stilling of activity, the stilling of doing, of striving, of efforting, from any kind of self-centered basis, wholesome or unwholesome. The way is in non-doing, non-fabricating. One meditator in an interview described their mind as like a broad lake over which no wind was blowing, so there were no ripples in it. This is part of that quality. I was visiting Kathmandu one time, and I was taking some teachings from a Tibetan teacher whom I know there, named Sogni Rinpoche. So I would go up and visit his monastery and receive teachings. Then I was staying in a guest house in town, and I was practicing most of the day. And it so happened that visiting the monastery at that time was a very famous Tibetan master named Nyoshul Ken Rinpoche. He was a Dzogchen master, very, very highly regarded. One of my friends found out that Rinpoche was in town while I was and asked if I would give him some dana for them. So I prepared an envelope and went to the monastery and told Sony Rinpoche that I had some dana for Nyoshul Ken Rinpoche. So he arranged for me to meet him and offer the donation from my friend. And it took a few days to set up, as things do with Tibetans. So when I went to offer the dana, Nyoshul Ken had gotten a little bit formal. He'd put on a gold robe, and he was sitting in one of the shrine rooms in the monastery, and the interpreter was there, and his wife was there, and a couple of an attendant and a couple of Western students, and my teacher was there. And then there's little me, you know, coming in to make the offering of the dana. So I make my bows, and I offer him the envelope from my friend, and he accepts it. I was a little nervous because it was, you know, a little bit of pomp, more than I was used to, a little bit nervous. But I made the offering, and then he took my head in his hands and he blessed me, and then he gave me a look that was like nothing I'd ever seen before. So I was feeling a little nervous, but he was holding my head and he looked right in my eyes, and then something shifted in him, and I would say he went into his meditative state. And what happened was, as I was watching him, his eyes moved slightly apart, like he was looking way in the distance. And as I looked into those eyes, he became really, really still. So that looking in his eyes was like looking in this big ocean that just went on forever inside him. And as I thought about it afterwards, I thought, you know, to say that his mind was still was not accurate. There was no mind there to be either still or moving. And he was at a level of peace that I didn't even know was possible for a human being. And I trusted my perceptions because I'd been meditating for about 2 weeks, fairly steadily at that point. I was very open, and I felt I had a very good connection with what he was showing me, with what he was offering. And I actually felt that he had just, in that moment, by his own volition, had shifted into the unconditioned. And that was a meditative skill that he had. And by offering it to me, he let me see what was possible. His eyes were totally unguarded, totally undefended. He just shifted, was completely open. But as I looked in him, I realized how undefended he was, and therefore how open I was, and I got nervous. And that fear caused just a little bit of contraction in me, and it covered over the receptivity to that space. And I just thought, if I could only have kept looking a little longer, who knows what might have happened. But it was still a beautiful moment of transmission, and it made me think that I could see how so many people could get enlightened listening to the Buddha, because I believe he had that ability for that level of stillness and probably more, that people could look in his eyes and feel what he had discovered and what he could turn his mind to when he chose. So for me, this was a validation of what's possible for each of us. This is our human potential, and this is where our path of practice leads. It leads to this state of the end of karma, of stillness and non-doing. So I'm just going to close with one other description of Nibbana. This is from the Udana again. One who is dependent has wavering. One who is independent has no wavering. There being no wavering, there is calm. There being calm, there is no desire. There being no desire, there is no coming or going. There being no coming or going, there is no passing away or arising. There being no passing away or arising, there is neither a here nor a there nor an in-between. This, just this, is the end of suffering. Let's just sit together for a moment, please. The stilling of all formations, the relinquishment of all attachments, the destruction of craving and cessation, that is, Nibbana.